Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes College Radio. Today's Wednesday, May 14th, 2014. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are literary agent Colleen Mohide and Ivy Pachota. Before we bring Colleen on, I just want to say thank you to all of you who donated in the last couple of weeks to our fund drive, our semi-annual fund drive. You're going to help keep the lights on. You're helping to keep the show on the air, and you're making Marie Nicole and myself feel appreciated, the most important thing of all. So thank you for that. We're going to bring on literary agent Colleen Mohide. She's been a partner in the Doe Coover Agency in Boston for 22 years and represents an eclectic range of fiction, nonfiction, memoir, biography, all sorts of things. She has a wonderful website. We'll get her to give the URL in a bit. Her authors include the late Caroline Knapp, author of the best-selling memoirs Drinking, A Love Story, and Pack of Two; Suzanne Byrne, author of The Ghost at the Table and winner of the 1999 Orange Prize for Fiction; and Marjorie Sandor, whose story collection, Portrait of My Mother, Who Posed Nude in Wartime, won the National Jewish Book Award in Fiction in 2004. Prior to becoming an agent, Mohide was an editor in the trade division of Little Brown and Company. Let's bring her on. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, Barbara.
So
thank
great.
You so much for inviting me on. I'm very glad to know that there are still radio shows out there aimed at writers and readers.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I love to have agents on because, one reason is because so much in publishing changes so quickly, and usually the only time writers come in contact with agents is if they go to a conference or they send something to an agent and get a response, which often makes them unhappy. Sometimes it makes them happy, but, you know, just wanting to know what goes on behind the walls is, I think, important to all writers. So, but first, you know, I wonder if you would talk about what's it like agenting from Boston?
Well, it is wonderful agenting from Boston. While the majority of agents certainly are located in New York, we are a very short train ride from New York, and but for years there was a really strong base of publishing in Boston. Houghton Mifflin originated in Boston, and it still has an office here. Little Brown, with whom I was an editor for 11 years, started in Boston, and it is really only in the last few years that they totally moved to New York, unfortunately. So, and Beacon Press is still here, Addison Wesley, a number of smaller publishers. And as a result, there is a really good community of agents in Boston, so that often editors will travel up from New York and take several days and visit the Boston agents. I think the only other city with another good community of agents is probably Washington, another short distance to New York. So we are mostly centered here on the East Coast, but you know, when I travel down to New York to visit with editors, they sometimes tell me that they see more of the Boston or Washington agents than they do of the New York agents, just because once you get to your desk every day, you're kind of tied down. You've got meetings in-house, and it just sometimes it's hard to get out and see people, and especially now where you don't have as much reason to have to see people face-to-face with all the different forms of communication. A lot of that more personal business that used to get done over lunch or just in a more social setting gets done now electronically. Unfortunately, I think we've lost a lot with that. But as a result, it is not at all hard working from Boston. And of course, Boston, with its, you know, nickname, the Athens of America, we've got a wonderful community of writers here, probably one of the biggest in the country. And between the, you know, hospitals and universities and all kinds of businesses, this such a kind of brain trust in Boston. So it sometimes seems like every other person you meet here is a writer or wannabe writer. So as an agency, we represent people all over the world and certainly all over the country, but there are a lot of writers in Boston and New England that we represent as well.
Interesting. So you represent fiction and nonfiction, and I'm curious if what you are looking for is influenced by what is selling or what we read about in Publishers Lunch or Publishers Weekly, or if it remains sort of a gut reaction, really, that something comes in that just speaks to you, and regardless of what the marketplace is doing with that particular genre, you go for it.
Well, both of those things are true, and they fortunately are not mutually exclusive. You know, agents work on commission, and so we really only make a living if we sell most of what we take on to represent. And so in order to stay in business and be successful, which of course is the only way that we would attract good writers, we have to sell more of what we take on. So we really do have to be very cognizant that what we take on, that we feel the odds are high that we're going to sell it. So we're very aware of what the marketplace is looking for. So if I see a project and I just love it and I wish I could work with that author and I wish I could sell it, if I just know that from experience, from trying to sell other similar projects, that editors are going to come back with some stock answer as to why books like that aren't selling right now, I just can't take it on. You know, time is money, and I can't put that kind of effort into it. That said, for agents who have a successful business, and all of us, I would have to say, go into this because we love writing and we love, it's kind of the thrill of the hunt. You know, editors find their projects through agents. Agents, however, don't have that one source to go to the way editors do to find their projects. We have to be out there beating the bushes, looking in creative and not so straightforward ways to find authors. And so as a result, we come across things that we just find we love and we wish we could sell and we want to work with. And so if we're successful, we can take on a certain percentage of projects that just because we believe in, we really hope that we will find that one other person who wants, one other editor who will take that kind of risk that we want to take with the book as well. And so we really do look for that project that even if we think there's nothing else out there like it that is on the bestseller list and therefore editors may not want to take it on or there's not going to be a huge clamoring for it by a number of editors, that we're getting that sort of instinct, that kind of buzz you feel when you just feel that the project should find a wider audience and that you want to be the agent who helps that book find a wider audience. So we do take things on, I think, that we're hoping to, say, break the mold with or make it the first book of its type out there so that what will come in its wake are other books like it.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Colleen Mohide. Her agency is the Doe Coover Agency in Boston. I found the website. It's doecooveragency.com, doecooveragency.com. How much then do you work with an author on a proposal or a manuscript before you send it out? And is that common? Is that a common thing for agents to do without an editing background like yours?
Well, you know, every proposal or manuscript comes in at a little bit different stage in being close to what we would consider publishable. So that when I am considering a proposal or a manuscript, I have to think that it's fairly close to publication. I can't take on raw material and kind of, you know, turn it into a jewel. That's too soon in the process for an author to approach an agent. Something has to come in where I can look at it and say, if I see what this still needs, and if I work with the author and we do X, Y, or Z on the manuscript, then it will take it the distance from being fairly close to putting it over the top, to making it publishable. So an author still really needs to bring a project just to as high a state of polish as that author possibly can before approaching an agent. I think one of the big, big mistakes that authors make is approaching an agent too early. And then they get discouraged because they're being rejected. If they put more work into it, the rate of being taken on by an agent is going to be higher. So I take on things where I feel like I can edit it to the point of turning it over to an editor at a publishing house. So the work varies. One of the things I tell my authors when I take them on is to not get discouraged, because usually we go back and forth with refining and polishing a manuscript anywhere from, I would say, 3 to 10 times to get it just in perfect shape to send out to an editor. Because as much of your audience will know, editors, unfortunately, are doing less editing these days. It's just a condition of the way publishing houses have been taken over by corporations, and they're just not given the time and the luxury to work with authors the way they used to and really get in and turn someone's manuscript, take a year to work with someone on a manuscript and help develop their career. So a lot of that is falling back on agents a great deal more than it used to. So we really do a fair amount of editing up front, knowing that it's going to get less editing once it gets to the publisher. Or for me to sell it, I need to edit it to a greater degree.
Interesting. So the point of entry, I would assume, is still a query letter. If a writer is looking for an agent and hasn't met an agent at a conference or whatever, in which case a query letter might still be the point of entry.
Oh, yes.
But what talk about the elements of a great query letter, what you look for.
Well, one of the suggestions I make to writers in looking at how to shape their query is to study jacket copy, flap copy on books. Because a query letter is a funny hybrid type of writing that few people ever really have to write. They're looking to put their best foot forward and demonstrate their writing ability right in the query letter. It's also a marketing and sales tool, and so you are looking to be very persuasive in a short amount of space to get me to want to read more. And so you want to synopsize what the story is, whether it's the plot line and character description of your novel, or if it's a nonfiction subject, then you want to still give a synopsis of the full range of the book from A to Z. But you're doing it in a short, generally one page. And that's really difficult for people who have written a whole, taken you know, the length of an entire book to describe what they want to describe, to now boil it down. And so I think the most analogous type of writing to that is the flap copy, in which you, the reader, say you walk into a Barnes & Noble and you just want something to read for that weekend. And what's going to persuade you to pick one novel up and take it to the cash register instead of another? And that's the catalog copy, because as a reader, you're getting an idea. Is this a storyline that I want to read? Is this interesting? Is this what I want to spend my time with? But it also has that marketing piece where it's telling you what the reward or the payoff from reading this novel is. Is it a mystery and I'm going to, you know, sort of really be kept on the edge of my seat up until the last page? Is it a story about history that I, you know, the Civil War that I haven't read before? As a Civil War buff, I'm going to find out something that I don't haven't known before. So it's a promise to first the agent, if it's the query letter, to me, the agent, that this book is going to keep me turning pages. And so a good query letter gives me the synopsis. It gives me some of your background, but only background that's really pertinent to the book you're writing. One of the things that tips me off that the writer is not capable of writing, say, a complete book, is if there's a lot of clutter in the query letter. People include a lot of things to do with their hobbies, their pets, their family. You know, I don't need to know that. That's just not pertinent to what you're writing. The other thing they do in query letters, we get this a lot, and it again tips me off that maybe I'm not really in the hands of someone who has a good handle on what they're writing. Maybe they're not well read in the areas that they're writing in, which I want to know as well, that they really understand who their competition is and who their audience is. And that's if they compare themselves to the masters. I mean, I get descriptions in query letters all the time for first novels, and the writer tells me that if you like Dickens and Twain and Faulkner, that you'll love my novel. And it tells me right away that the person does not have a good idea of their own writing or who the audience is for the book. But if they tell me some other writers out there who are contemporary and may not be bestsellers, but who they think they're analogous to in terms of tone or voice, or that a similar audience is going to want to read their book, then I understand that they are more professional in going about their search for an agent, that they're looking for an agent who probably represents books similar to theirs.
Hmm. Interesting.
The other thing that really turns agents off, I think, is if right away you start telling me that your book is going to make a terrific movie. Because we're looking for writers. And, of course, it's frosting on the cake if eventually your book does get made into a movie. But if someone is more concerned with the kind of attention or fame that goes along with a movie than they are really with their own craft of writing, or the audience of readers out there, then that kind of tells me that they're getting ahead of themselves as well.
Interesting. This time has flown by, Colleen. I wonder if in closing you might offer a really important tip for writers approaching you or any agent.
Well, I think it is to really, similarly to what I was just saying, is to show me that you really do know your market and that you've been working all along at your writing, that you didn't just decide yesterday to write a book, but that you've been, tell me in my query, in your the query letter to me, that you've been trying to get shorter articles published, what your writing background is, maybe even what other writers you admire, so that it gives me an idea on what type of reader you are. One of the problems I see is that an awful lot of people who want to write don't actually read a lot. And so it makes me wonder what their interest is in writing. I think that that's an important thing to tell an agent. Maybe tell me that you've been, what other conferences you've been attending, or the kind of interest that you've been paying to your writing life and to publishing in general. And that will tell me, I think, that you're a serious student of the work that you're doing. And I also think that if you are pitching a book, you want to make sure that you tell me not only what makes the book unique to you, what it is that you are bringing to it, that only you can bring to it, but the flip side is what's not unique, what's universal about it, and therefore how this is going to interest a wider audience.
You have been quite enlightening.
Thank you. Thank you.
I wish we had you for an hour. Thank you just so much for taking the time to be here today.
Oh, well, you're welcome, and thank you so much for having me. I hope that I've been able to give some good advice, and of course, I like to encourage writers to keep writing, so, and keep reading.
And keep reading. Very important. And keep the bookstores in business here.
That's right.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Barbara. Thank you.
That was Colleen Mohide. Her agency is the Doe Coover Agency in Boston. And look for a Q&A that I did with Colleen that's going to be in the July-August issue of the ASJA Monthly. She will be there. It's the ASJAMonthly.org. Sorry, no, the ASJAMonthly.org. And every month, actually, there's all kinds of wonderful articles that that non-members as well as members can find on our website. Stay tuned. When we come back, we should have Ivy Picciotto with us. Don't go anywhere. Thank you. and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes at College Radio. First half hour, I was here with literary agent Colleen Mohait of the Doe Coover Agency in Boston, and I am back with Ivy Pakoda. Ivy's the author of Visitation Street, published by Echo Dennis Lehane Books. Visitation Street was a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers selection. Ivy's writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Review of Books, the Huffington Post, Self, and House & Garden. Her first novel, The Art of Disappearing, was published by St. Martin's Press in 2009. She has a BA from Harvard College in Classical Greek and an MFA from Bennington College in Fiction. And she grew up in Boston, currently lives in LA. Let's bring her on. Hi, Ivy.
Hi, how are you? I actually grew up in Brooklyn, not Boston.
Okay, Brooklyn.
just wanted to correct that because my book's set in Brooklyn.
Yeah. No, yeah. You're right. And my last guest was from Boston.
So, okay.
My brain went to Boston. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Talk about Visitation Street and how it came about.
Well, I was living in a neighborhood in Brooklyn called Red Hook, which is about a mile and a half from where I grew up. I grew up in a neighborhood called Cobble Hill. But Red Hook is worlds away. It's cut off by a highway called the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway. That's sort of ghettoized Red Hook because there's not a lot of public transportation. So as the rest of the city developed, Red Hook just stayed the way it was. It was a longshoreman's, waterfront community, and there was a pretty big housing project. And I moved there in 2005, I think. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I moved there, around 2005. And, I just started to write about what was going on outside my window, all the different people who lived in this isolated, unique place in New York. And that was the genesis for the book, was just trying to, capture the panorama of life in Red Hook. The story came a little bit later, so I just really wanted to, pay tribute to this really colorful and vibrant community.
How much of the story did you know going in? Because you have sort of a complicated plot happening here. You have, I think, 5 point of view characters.
Yeah, I didn't really have much of an idea of what the plot was going to be when I began to write. As I said earlier, I was really much more interested in describing the neighborhood. And, there are different aspects. I mean, there are different factions in the community. There's sort of the old dock worker people and the sort of a white working class community who've evolved past, the dock worker stage because the docks have been long closed. And then there's the African-American, predominantly African-American housing project, and then there's some sort of gentrifying newcomers like artists and creative types who have moved in. And then I had 5 different points of view because I felt, though I didn't make a conscious decision to do so, but I was writing about those various aspects of the community, I had 5 characters who I believe represented different parts of Red Hook. And the story kind of grew out of that. I just after writing for about 100 pages, I wasn't quite sure what united them. And then I realized that, I had written a little section about girls who go out on a raft and one goes missing, and I realized that would be the through line, that we unite all the aspects of the community.
Hmm. Yeah, I was so curious from the beginning. The girls go out on the raft and everything changes after that point. And then, getting to the end of the book without giving anything at all away, I was so pleased with how you wrapped it up. And because you didn't have much of an idea, you said you didn't have much of an idea going in. When did the ending come to you? I mean, when did you know how it was going to end?
Well, it's funny. It's a really good question. And thank you for saying that I wrapped it up well, because there are many times along the way where I just thought, oh, no, it's just never going to come together. When I was about 2/3 of the way through, I always knew where I wanted all the characters to end up. I knew where I wanted them to be emotionally and physically, and what I wanted them to have to realize and discovered about themselves, and which ones I wanted to leave Red Hook and which ones I wanted to stay behind. So I knew all of that, and I kind of had an idea about how I wanted the emotional symphony to come together at the end of the book. But I wasn't quite sure about how to just
tie it together with the nuts and bolts of a plot. And, you know, I gave it to a friend of mine to read, and she just made a simple comment, doesn't this one character discover what happens to that one character? And I said, I guess. And, you know, and then I thought, of course, that's perfect. It's not a huge decision. I might have come up with it myself, but it just gave me this end point to write towards, the character who makes the major discovery at the end. I just thought, okay, well, as long as I know that this person's going to make that discovery, I can fill in all the kind of cool details about everybody else along the way. So it took me a long time to figure out how it was all going to dovetail.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Ivy Pakoda. Her novel is Visitation Street. One interesting aspect that unfolded for me was from the start. Well, not from the start. At a certain point, I understood that what your character Val was dealing with was very similar to what your character Jonathan was dealing with. And I wondered if that was on your mind during the writing of the book, or is that something that readers bring to it and say, hey, did you know that they were going through the same thing, only differently?
I mean, you know, yes, I think they are. I didn't start off saying, okay, they're going to have similar journeys at different stages in their lives. But, you know, I wanted Val's fascination with Jonathan to go deeper than, you know, childish infatuation. I wanted there to be something real and, you know, troubling connecting them. And I wanted his interest in her also to be grounded in some kind of, you know, desire to save her from herself, and he would have to recognize something about himself in her. So, you know, I didn't know how. I always knew that, you know, his child, I always knew his backstory and what happened with his mother. I wasn't sure how, I didn't exactly plan that to mirror what happens with Val in her life. But as I wrote, it became really evident to me that they were sort of going through the same thing, and it made him really want to look out for her, and it made her mistake her own interest in him for, you know, something almost romantic, where it's actually she's identifying with him on a deeper level, mm-hmm. and she can realize because she's only 15 or 16. So, you know, I didn't start off saying, okay, well, I'm going to have two characters, and this is going to happen to this one when he's a kid, and this is going to happen to this one when she's a kid, and, you know, they're going to be parallels, or they're going to be, you know, juxtaposed. But it did sort of develop that way as I was writing.
Something else I was really curious about, because I first learned of you at Literary Orange back in March, I think it was, when you sat on a magical realism panel. And I came away from the panel. Actually, I didn't come away from the panel thinking this. I came away from the book thinking about magical realism and how that fits in with your book. And there was one scene where I could see that. But I was wondering what you thought, and when you were asked to be on a magical realism panel, what you thought about that in terms of your book.
Well, you know, I don't really believe that this book has any magical realism in it. You know, I think that there's definitely spirituality, and there's some, there's the presence of ghosts and a ghostly presence of the old neighborhood in the book. And I use ghosts as a way to, you know, some of the characters really do believe they can talk to the dead, and I do leave it up to the reader to determine whether that's real or not. So you could say it's a coping mechanism for dealing with grief, or, you know, maybe it is really happening, but there's never a point in the book where talking to the dead becomes so concretely, you know, provable that it's magical realism. It can be one way or the other. I believe I was asked to sit on that magical realism panel because of my previous novel, which is awash in magical realism.
I see.
So, you know, it was a little difficult to spin this book. But there are definitely, like, some inexplicable things in this book. Mm-hmm. But I like to leave it open to the reader's interpretation, you know, whether that's magical realism or the character's own fantasy.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, that makes sense. And when I started reading the book, I wasn't really looking for that. You know, I just, I love literary suspense, which is how I saw this. And I don't know if you at any point thought this is what I'm writing, or if, I think I recall you seeing something about an agent or editor, somebody
My
came
editor.
Back and said, hey, how about that mystery or thriller you're writing? And you said, what?
Yeah, no, it was after I sold it, my editor showed me the cover, and she said, isn't this, you know, oh, no, no. She said, we're going to send this out to Dennis Lehane for a blurb. And I thought, why would Dennis Lehane blurb my book? She said, well, you know, you've written a big old mystery. And I thought, I have? I didn't ever plan to write a mystery, though I suppose it is a mystery. And, you know, I am very interested in mystery. Not in terms of, well, I am in terms of, you know, reading mysteries, but I love sort of something that's hanging over, you know, a book or hanging over a society or a family, some kind of unsolved issue that, you know, is driving the plot. So I never thought, oh, I'm going to write a mystery with a girl who goes missing and then we find out what happens and there's going to be, you know, clues and stuff like that. I'm going to mislead you. But, you know, that sort of turned out the way the, you know, the books are turned out that way, though completely unintentional. Though I have to say, you know, now I can read it as a bit more of a literary suspense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I thought it was wonderful. I was also curious about your side characters who aren't all that much of side characters. I mean, you definitely have a couple of main characters, but your side characters are so interesting, too, and remind me of something I read or heard somewhere where, you know, make your side characters think the book is about them.
That's really interesting.
You know, so they can shine and try to take over the book, even though you don't let them. And so I was curious, you know, coming up with these side characters of Cree and you know, Ren, and then Fadi, who has the store. Talk about that and how they sort of came into the story, entered the story.
Well, you know, I thought, again, as I said earlier, Cree is a young African-American man who lives in the housing project, and I felt that I couldn't write about Red Hook without writing about the housing project. It's really, the neighborhood is equally divided between the white working-class waterfront and the predominantly African-American housing project. And one of the really interesting things about Red Hook is this, like, actual, like, there's a line down the middle, and you know people cross to go to the store, but you know, so one type of person lives on one side and the other type lives on the other side, and you know, but it comes to, there are moments of, you know, overlap. And I thought, you know, Cree was really emblematic of someone who grew up in this housing project, who's really never been outside his community, who's trying to visualize a life outside of it. I have a couple of acquaintances who do live in that housing project, and I always sort of wondered, they're older now, they're in their 60s, and I always wondered why they never moved, you know, or why they didn't look for a life outside of Red Hook. Obviously, their whole family and community is there, but I just sort of wondered that, and I sort of wanted to write about a young man who is at that crossroads in his life of deciding whether he's going to stay or move on. And Fadi he's a Lebanese bodega owner. So, you know, that's another section of the community, these outside merchants who sort of service the community, who are trying to become part of it and, you know, are just totally outsiders. As much as he wants to participate in life in Red Hook, people, you know, Red Hook can be a little closed off and a little insular, and people keep to themselves and don't really, you know, we're not always the nicest to visitors. So, you know, Fadi wants to be part of the community, but he just can't be, because he lives in a different neighborhood. So I just wanted to talk, you know, make sure all those sides are represented. And I guess the reason that they feel as real, as important as everyone else in the book is that, you know, every single person who exists in Red Hook or in the world believes that they are as important or mm-hmm. they have as equal, you know, right to belong there as anybody else. So, you know, I never thought of, like, primary or secondary characters while I was writing.
That's interesting. Love to hear you read. Could you read a little bit?
Sure, I will. So a couple pages?
Yeah.
Okay. The girls choose the water between the Beard Street Pier and the rotting factory, where a two-masted sailboat is taking its time sinking into the murky basin. Never mind that the water is dirty and that they aren't the best swimmers. And never mind that they are going to have to paddle through that grimy water with their hands. They figure they'll float around this pier and past the next two, then get out on the little beach next to Valentino Pier. It couldn't take more than half an hour. It's crazy dark down by the water. Their footsteps are loud and hard, bouncing off the warehouses. Only a 10-minute walk from home, yet they'd never been to the waterfront at night, never been to this stretch of waterfront period. Until they got in sight of the water, they pretended their parents' warnings were a lot of nonsense. But now there seems to be something hiding in each shadow, scattering the litter and rubble. it doesn't seem possible that they have this place to themselves. There must be someone lurking behind the cracked windshield of a rusted-out station wagon, someone watching them from the ruins of the sugar refinery. The waterfront creaks and resettles. The decaying groan of old wood is a ghostly moan. The rhythmic bang of a boat against the pier is the approaching of footsteps. Something clatters down the refinery's dilapidated chute and plunges into the water. The girls grasp hands and start singing, chanting, making a lot of noise, trying to outdo whatever fell down that chute, attempting to subdue the darkness. But the brick warehouse and the basin throw the song back, distorting their voices so they sound unfamiliar to themselves. June points at the sugar refinery. "Heard it's haunted," she says. "Probably someone over there right now watching us." Val glances at the skeleton of the refinery. "Ghosts better not mess with us," June says. "You want to go back?" Val says. There's movement in the refinery. She's sure of it. Something, someone, rattling in the large metal dome. "Nah," June says, turning her back to the building. But Val can't take her eyes off it. She watches the chute, checking to see if it sways. The girls turn up the volume, chanting louder. They tiptoe onto the green-fuzzed rocks and lower the raft into the water. June stands back. "You first," she says. Val shakes her head. "Your raft, your idea," June says. Val squats down, trying to avoid touching the rocks, and falls back onto the raft. It buckles under her weight, and she's swamped by the oily water. "Nasty," she says. June closes her eyes and scrunches her face, then sits down behind Val. The raft submerges, soaking the girls up to their chests. "Damn, that's cold," June says, shaking as if she can escape the wet, and nearly knocking the girls into the drink. Then the raft adjusts to their weight, pops back up, and they float. The water is chilly and slick. The girls paddle hard and erratically with their hands, pushing away the junk that keeps approaching the raft and trying not to look at the gloomy area underneath the crumbling sugar refinery. The raft swings close to the half-sunk sailboat, and the girls kick frantically, not wanting to tempt whatever went down with it. The water smells rank. There's something pulling from below that makes the raft spin. "What is that?" Val asks. She feels the raft buckle in the middle. She stops paddling and lets the pink rubber flatten out beneath them. "It's like a water slide," June says through clenched teeth. "Yeah, just like Coney Island," Val says. She checks the shoreline that is quickly sliding away behind them. They clutch the raft with rigid hands. They are unwilling to let go, unable to pull themselves out of the swirling current. "Don't rip it with your nails," Val says. They're out deep now, too far from the questionable comfort of the shore. "We've got to paddle," she says. They let go and slap the water with their hands. Finally, they get out past the pier and let their arms rest. They float into the basin, where the water has a regular beat, the moon shining like it's out of its mind. The raft is handed from one wave to the next. To their left, Staten Island is glittering, its houses lighting up its hills with an LCD display of red, green, and white. Tankers like shining islands sit in the bay, heavy and motionless. Straight across, the cranes in the port of New Jersey look like some kind of Jurassic fantasy land. A tugboat passes in front of them. The girls scream and bend forward and try to balance so they're not swamped in its wake. Small waves break over their legs and waists. Floating is wilder than Val expected. The silhouettes of the city and Jersey rising on all sides, the water stretching out dark and vast. But it's the silence, only now and then disturbed by the call of the foghorn, the crash of a wave tangling with the pylons, the rhythmic beat of a boat somewhere out there that grabs her. They float by the wreck of a tugboat. The moon is trapped in one of the sunken windows, its reflection struggling through the dark water. The girls grasp the edge of the raft and see the blank eyes of the portholes staring back at them. There's a new swell in the water, a deep, insistent tug. If Val could forget the bay's depths, she would be willing to follow this current wherever it leads her. "We could keep going forever," Val says, looking over her shoulder at June. June is no longer clutching the raft. She's trailing her hands in the water, small ripples receding from her fingertips. As the raft rounds another pier, the Manhattan skyline bursts into view, towering over the black hump of Governor's Island. The buildings claw the sky as if they are desperate to get out. The girls are pulled forward by the fresh current of Buttermilk Channel, but it seems to them that the city is drawing them in. "That's where we belong," June says. She raises her arms and snaps her fingers. "No more wasting time." "Stop it," Val says. She's not looking at the city. She's watching its reflection stretching out into the water in front of them. Stop.
Mm, Thank you so much. That was Ivy Pakoda reading from Visitation Street. Was that always the title?
Yes. It was called Up All Night for a while, and then I switched it to Visitation Street when I made the characters younger.
And plus, as you said, it's place is such a character in this book. I mean, the setting. You know, I was curious about it too. If you wrote it after you left Red Hook, if you started writing it afterward.
I started writing while I was living there, and then I moved. I wrote a couple chapters, 4 or 5 chapters while I was still there, but I wrote most of it after I left.
Interesting.
Makes it a little easier, I think.
Yeah. And I think I was on Goodreads, and someone wrote a review of the book and he also loved the book and wrote or actually inserted pictures. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have, yeah.
And it was interesting because that's kind of how I pictured it from your writing before I looked
at it. He hit all the landmarks.
Yeah, it's interesting. It was interesting to come across that. We are at the end of our time. I wonder if in closing you have any words of advice for the writers who are listening, who may be working their way through a novel.
Sure. My advice that I always give anyone who asks me that question is write the book you want to read. Don't write the book you think you should read or the book you think will sell or the book you think people expect of you. Write the book that you would most like to pick up and take on an airplane or on vacation. I think too many writers are, focused on commercial or, trying to be too literary and, think about the books that really entertain you and write exactly that book.
Yeah, that's great advice. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
That was Ivy Pakoda. Her book is Visitation Street. She has a website, ivypakoda.com. And that is all we have today for you. Again, thank you to all of you who donated during the fund drive. And I'm going to leave you now. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. See you next week.